headlines this hour. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, tells the visiting Pope Francis that Christian citizens should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security. The Pentagon says it is considering keeping National Guard troops at the U.S. Capitol amid continued threats from extremist groups. In Myanmar, security forces once again clashed with protesters in the city of Yangon as a top UN official calls for action to end the post-coup violence. Well, welcome to Studio C in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, in a meeting with the Pope Francis, has emphasized the role of religious leaders in resolving crises facing humanity. Ayatollah Sistani said that many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He said the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. Ayatollah Sistani also said that Iraq's Christian citizens should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani met with the visiting Pope at his home in the Iraqi city of Najaf. Meanwhile, Pope Francis also gave a speech in an interfaith service in Iraq's ancient city of Ur, where he called for cooperation between religions for achieving peace. The pontiff said the Muslims and Christians are peacemakers and they need to work together. He called faith the most important element in human life, saying that it is only through belief that people can be united. Pope Francis added that people need to commit themselves to achieve developments that would help them overcome global struggles. He slammed those who exploit religion for extremism and terrorism. He also made a plea for peace in the Middle East, emphasizing on the people of Syria. He said that freedom of religion is a fundamental right that should be recognized everywhere. The Pentagon says that it is reviewing a request to extend the presence of National Guard troops deployed to the U.S. Capitol following the January 6th insurrection. Defense Department spokesman John Kirby says Capitol Police have asked for the continued assistance of the National Guard for another 2 months. Some 5,000 troops were mobilized and barriers erected around the Capitol after thousands of supporters of then-President Donald Trump stormed the building. They asked after Trump called them to stop lawmakers from certifying Joe Biden's election win. The breach led to the death of 5 people, including a policeman. More than 270 people are being prosecuted for their participation in the attack. Authorities have been on high alert since Thursday, after intelligence showed a possible plot by a militia group to breach Congress again. Colin Campbell says U.S. politicians want to keep National Guard troops at the Capitol to show that they are doing something to prevent a new insurrection.
The U.S. government believes that the National Guard needs to have a presence to either intimidate anyone who may want to cause harm or to intervene in case there are people actively engaged in trying to create destruction. And I think that's why they're extending this. There are other reporters who I spoke to this week who believe that this National Guard is being put in place so that politicians can show that they're doing something because they missed the boat on January 6th, that they overlooked things, they should have been more diligent, and they weren't, and this is their mode of playing catch-up to have the National Guard there now. It looks like because of these potential insurgencies that could come to Congress, could come to Washington, National Guard will be up in D.C. longer than anticipated.
Myanmar's security forces have once again clashed with anti-coup protesters in the country's largest city, Yangon. The security forces fired tear gas and destroyed the barricade erected by the protesters. On Friday, the police opened fire on the protesters in another city, killing a man. More than 50 have been killed since the coup. The UN described last Wednesday as the bloodiest when 40 people were killed. The UN Special Envoy in Myanmar has called on the Security Council for action against the post-coup violence in the Southeast Asian country. Myanmar has been engulfed by chaos after the army seized power on February the 1st, alleging fraud in the last parliamentary elections. It also detained a number of civilian officials, including the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Indian farmers have blocked the 6-lane expressway outside of the capital, New Delhi, to mark the 100th day of their protest against the new agricultural reforms. Farmers, young and old, headed in cars, trucks, and tractors to the highway for a 5-hour roadblock to oppose 3 farm laws enacted in September 2020. They say that the laws hurt them by opening up the agriculture sector to private players. The fresh protest comes to add pressure on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. Meanwhile, Modi has called the laws much needed for the country's vast and antiquated agriculture sector. He has dismissed the protests as politically motivated. Tens of thousands of farmers have been camped out on the outskirts of the capital since December, demanding that the laws be repealed. I'm going to go back to our story about the Pope's visit to Iraq. Sayed Hosseini is the head of the Islamic Center of Johannesburg, who joins us from Johannesburg. We also have Said Shahabi, who's an activist and West Asia expert, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Said Shahabi, let me first start with you. Obviously, this is a very important visit since the Pope has not visited Iraq. Tell us the different aspects of why this marks an important visit, especially when it comes to how it could help Iraq in a bigger picture in terms of its security.
Thank you very much. Of course, it is a great opportunity to have the Pope going to Iraq, visiting the Marja, the big jurist in Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani, at the place where the leader of the Shia Muslims, Imam Ali, is buried. So this is significant. Now, we also have to look at the background of this visit, and we must not forget the efforts by many people before that. Iran started to have dialogue with the Pope from the very first days of the revolution when they opened their embassy in the Vatican. And here today, I want to remember and to pay homage to the late Sayyid Hadi Khusru Shahi, who was the first Iranian ambassador to the Pope, to the Vatican, and who died this time last year, a year ago, because of Corona. So this is one. And then, of course, there were many delegations from Iran to the Vatican to establish this dialogue between Muslims, Shia Islam, and also the Catholic Christianity. Iraqi scholars have been going also in the last few years to Vatican several times. They met with the Pope. So this is the backdrop of the visit by the Pope, but also we must not forget that he had visited Cairo also. So he considered, he wanted to establish dialogue with Muslims through Azhar, Al-Azhar in Cairo, through Najaf in Iraq. And of course, this was prepared by the efforts of those early visitors to the Vatican. And I think today, this is a crystallization of those efforts, and we are hopeful that in the future there will be more dialogue, more openness, more mutual respect and understanding among the faiths.
Sayed Hosseini, when you take a look at how the Pope, obviously holding the highest position there in the Christian world, versus what we're looking at with Ayatollah al-Sistani, who is the most revered leader, religious leader there in Iraq. What could come out of that is very important in terms of uniting Iraq, the negative elements, and of course, at the same time, showing religious coexistence. To what benefit would this have for Iraq, this meeting between the two?
Well, meeting of two grand leaders of the Christianity and the Shia Islam in Iraq is a historical event which happens for the first time, and there are three things to be discussed about this important visit. One is that the number of Christians in Iraq, 10 people before war, and then since this has started, now the number is about 250,000. It's because of the from the time of Saddam, I know, up to now, there was different elements which has led to the migration or killing of some of the Christian, and the Pope should actually recognize the great general, Iranian general Soleimani, who has actually saved Christians, saved the churches, and this Pope actually has to recognize the efforts of this great man saving the Christian's life and the Christian church and Christian identity in Iraq. That is the one issue. The second issue is Visitation of Ayatollah Sistani as a grand marja of the Shia world, whom is living in a very rented house compared to his own in Vatican. I'm sure he is very much impressed with the lifestyle of this, the simplicity style of our leader Ayatollah Sistani, and I think though what he is going to take for himself as a lesson is the comparison between his style as a leader of the entire Catholics of the world and the leader of the Shia world, Ayatollah Sistani. So that will be the spiritual income of that. But in general, I think the emphasis of the two leader on the harmony between the religions and common enemy which threatens both religions in Iraq, and cooperation and dialogue between religions and civilizations and identity. I think that will be a great result of the visitation of Pope, and this should not stop there. Probably a visitation by Ayatollah Sistani to Vatican can be a good answer to this, and also the outcome of what they are going to discuss in this meeting.
Well, the outcome is where it's at. And Said Shahabi, if we want to take a look at what Ayatollah Sistani has said, he to the Pope, he said that religious leaders need to encourage parties to conflicts in general, particularly world powers, he said, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. Do you think this type of message, and also overall this meeting, is how it's being viewed by world powers, in particular the U.S.?
Well, definitely the Pope has generally has been calling for peace, but also our leaders, Ayatollah Sistani, Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, all these leaders, especially Ayatollah Sistani now, who is living in Iraq, and he is the supreme leader of the Shia faith, they have been advocating peaceful coexistence, also dialogue, debate among religions. Many Shias have sacrificed themselves in order to defend the Christians in Iraq and also in Syria. Both of them, in Iraq and in Syria, they were targeted harshly. And I have met many Christians from Iraq and from Syria who were complaining about the lack of defense from the Arab leaders to their existence after they had been attacked by the ISIS terrorists. So the call to the world leaders is there, and it's clear whether those leaders will heed that call, whether they will put it into action, whether they will replace the language of force and sanctions and attacks, military attacks and so on, and the assassination of senior figures in the Arab and Muslim world, whether they will heed that call or not is a different matter. Unfortunately, the religious message is very clear. The religious message, the clear, clean, Abrahamic message is for peace, for dialogue, for coexistence, for mutual respect, for mutual recognition. But the politics have different different direction altogether and different priorities. Of course, we hope that the Washington and London and Brussels will heed this call and will extend working and fraternal and brotherly hands to the other people in the world, especially the Arabs and Muslims, and so that to avoid any confrontation and any military and bloodshed.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Said Hosseini, head of the Islamic Center for Johannesburg, spoke to us from Johannesburg. And thank you, Said Shahabi, activism West Asia expert, who spoke to us there from London. Many thanks to both of you. Moving on, Indian-controlled Kashmir has witnessed yet another angry protest after authorities reversed a decision to release the region's top Muslim cleric from house arrest. Protesters threw stones and clashed with police outside of the main mosque of the city of Srinagar after Friday prayers. They demanded the release of Mirwaz Omar Farooq, who has been under house arrest for 20 months. He was among dozens of religious and political figures put under house arrest in 2019. That after the ruling right-wing Indian government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked the special constitutional status of the disputed Himalayan region. Since then, New Delhi has also enforced a heavy security lockdown. India and Pakistan control parts of Kashmir, but both lay claim to the full area.
India claims violence has dropped significantly in Kashmir since New Delhi stripped the region of its special status in 2019. However, local politicians accuse the Indian government of silencing Kashmiri people by installing an atmosphere of fear. The question is, who is telling the truth? A lot has changed since India ended Kashmir's special status in August 2019. The region is now open to investors and non-locals who want to live there. Kashmir is also now open to workers from other parts of India. None of this was possible before New Delhi ended Kashmir's autonomy. India has been changing the laws applying to Kashmir on a wide scale since then, and these moves have gone largely unopposed. How has there not been any major agitation inside Kashmir? Political analysts believe the apparent silence does not mean the people of the region have consented to India's actions.
It is not silence, rather enforced silence, because of a situation of a sort of martial law or emergency, undeclared martial law or undeclared emergency that was imposed upon them in 2019. And since most of their leadership was put behind the jails, activists of all sorts were also detained. Therefore, a sort of muteness remained there.
Although the people of Kashmir are unhappy with New Delhi's recent decisions and policy changes, they fear that dissenting would have adverse repercussions.
When India decided to scrap Kashmir's special status, we were promised to be given more opportunities, jobs and accessibility. But soon after August 5, 2019, they did the total opposite of what they had promised. The worst thing is that we cannot even oppose it. And if we do so, we will end up in jail. What India has done is completely authoritarian and undemocratic.
However, despite a growing crackdown in the region, the recent ceasefire between India and Pakistan has brought a ray of hope.
Neither the silence is permanent, nor their postures, hard postures, are permanent. They are compelled because of international situations to dilute. I have often mentioned that Kashmir is a volcano which remains dormant for a while, but it erupts and surprises everyone. So the only solution to it is that the core issue and aspirations of people should be addressed so that people have a sense of achievement.
Kashmir has been a bone of contention between Islamabad and New Delhi ever since India broke from British rule in 1947. Pakistan and India each control a part of the region, but both claim it in full. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has won a vote of confidence in Parliament, keeping his government safe. Khan won 178 votes in support amid opposition, boycott and protest. His Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party has 157 lawmakers and required 14 more trust votes in the 342-member National Assembly. Prime Ministers voluntarily sought to face the floor test after his finance minister lost in a closely fought Senate race on Wednesday. The opposition had demanded the Premier resign after the debacle. And that is for this additional World News. This is bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you agree with me that travel is most rewarding when it surprises, then Iran might just be the most rewarding destination on Earth. By having lush, dense forests in the north, warm, sunny beaches in the south by the Persian Gulf, snowy mountains in the west, and amazingly hot deserts in the east, Iran is one of the few countries that gives the joy of experiencing four different seasons at the same time to travelers. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. With an area of 1.6 million square kilometers, Iran is the 18th largest country in the world and the second largest in the Middle East. Its area roughly equals the area of France, Spain, and Germany together. Iran's diverse and striking landscapes offer a wealth of breathtaking and spectacular views to discover. This week on Aperture's Iran Trotter series, Javad Gharayi will go to Bahu Kalat in the south of Iran, where the turquoise waters meet the hot sand of the desert. Here's the first part.
The living world is filled with unparalleled beauties. Beauties represented by Mother Nature across this beautiful planet. A planet that's been the only habitat for humans since they came into being millions of years ago. The beauties of nature have forever captivated humans everywhere. Many of what humans have created over millennia were inspired by their natural environment. To many humans, the word nature conjures up images of mountains and forests, but nature has thousands of other beautiful facets, and some of those facets manifest themselves in sharp contrast to each other. One of the most beautiful faces of Mother Nature is the barren areas of land, or deserts. Many nature explorers believe that deserts and steppes are the most beautiful parts of nature, and the most beautiful parts of these parts are the sand dunes and hills. But is there anywhere in the world with expanses of shifting dry sand dunes right next to a great body of salt water named the sea? Hi, I'm Javad Gharayi.
I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of this beautiful land. Chile is a beautiful country with unique natural exquisiteness. A country that remarkably has vast steppes and shifting sand dunes along the coast of the Pacific Ocean, offering a natural scene of unparalleled beauty. Of course, I haven't traveled to Chile's beautiful Pacific coast. My destination is the Bahu Kalat rural district in the south of Iran's Sistan and Baluchistan province. But I'm not going straight to Bahu Kalat. I begin my trip near the border between Hormozgan and Sistan and Baluchistan provinces. There are few places in the world where sand dunes meet the sea, creating a spectacular landscape. Such coastal deserts can only be seen in parts of Chile, in the Great African Sahara, and in the Southwest African country of Namibia. Some may find it hard to believe, but in addition to those few places in the world, there is an area in southern Iran where expansive sand fields meet the Sea of Oman. A place near the village of Darak in Zaravan County. The border between Sistan and Baluchistan and Hormozgan provinces, in the southernmost area of Baluchistan, on the coast of the Sea of Oman. In the past, this area of Iran was called Mukran. A name, researchers say, was derived from the word muk, meaning the palm tree. Given its large number of palm groves, Baluchistan can be referred to as the land of palm groves in Iran, an area with a beautiful history and peerless natural splendor. Unfortunately, the general public in Iran doesn't know much about Baluchistan. The sea, the sand dunes, and the Martian mountains, all in one place, provide an environment with no parallel in Iran and, I dare say, in the world. But the sand dunes, the Martian mountains, and the Sea of Oman aren't the only things that make this area of Baluchistan unique. It's the multitudes of palm and other trees scattered along this area, as well as the many herds of camels, goats, and sheep grazing among these dunes and mountains that make for breathtaking beauty. Here, Mother Nature has made all her efforts to create some of the most beautiful coastal sceneries in the world, and she's done a great job. This is the result of millions of years of work for Mother Nature. So it's incumbent upon us and the authorities to keep these unmatched beauties just as they are, by not allowing any structures, however small, to be built here or in the surrounding area. Not even a few gazebos for tourists and explorers to use. We have to preserve this natural magnificence as it is. A geopark is a unified area that advances the protection and use of geological heritage in a sustainable way and promotes the economic well-being of the people who live in it. geoparks are protected areas. Many countries dream of having one in its smallest and simplest shape and form. There are only a few geoparks around the world that are both geomorphologically rich and boast unique wildlife, history, culture, and indigenous populations. Countries with such wealth are few and far between. But this area of Balochistan is home to several morphological splendors. It's also inhabited by Baluch tribes of a rich culture. Their traditional lifestyle and time-honored customs, a pure, unspoiled natural environment, the preserved remains from the remote past, the golden sandy coastlines, and the deep turquoise blue waters of the Sea of Oman. The traditional fishing apparatus on boats moored at a beautiful port. And finally, very good vegetation and animal life. As I walk on beautiful sand hills, I think to myself, how are we responsible to the generations that will come into being in this country, to the natural beauties in our country? I'm spending today relishing the stunning untapped natural beauties in Zaravan and snap several beautiful pictures. The nagging question is, do we have the right to deny the children of tomorrow the opportunity to feast their eyes on such spectacular scenery? I wish no structure, no roads, nothing would be built among these ancient mountains, sand dunes, and palm groves. No hotels, no themed amusement parks to be built for human recreation on its untouched coastline. Even a few simple gazebos in the area can accelerate the destruction of this region's ecology and natural landscape. I wish all of us humans had more appreciation for the natural world, this manifestation of God Almighty's beauty, and paid it due respect. I wish all nature-loving tourists would choose to walk into the heart of nature, and by doing so prevented any harm to it. A lot of people in the world think that if they really want to enjoy their expedition into nature, they have to spend the nights in multi-star hotels near their destinations. But that's not the right mentality. It's not in anyone's interests. Hotels that are built close to natural habitats do nothing but damage an intricate ecology that's taken millennia to be formed. There's an alternative way for explorers to both enjoy their trips into the heart of nature and for the natural world to be spared damage by humans. In other words, for humans to forge a partnership with the natural world. Local homes, kapars, and black tents, and also camping tents are the best options. All the people and officials in this area of Balochistan say they hope that in the near future, the area they live in will be registered as an important and valuable geopark by the relevant authorities living in the capital city. And by doing so, they hope the unique natural environment here and the culture and customs of the old Baluch tribes inhabiting this region will be preserved and protected. I take great pleasure walking about in this beautiful natural landscape and accompanying camel herders, but this is the end of this leg of my journey. I have to set off for my main destination, the Bahu Kalat district in the north of Balochistan. The main purpose of this trip is to visit an idyllic little village by the name of Shir Gawaz, a lush, vast, green patch of land 30 kilometers to the border with Pakistan. The name Shir Gwaz was derived from the names of two wild animals, namely the lion and the boar. The locals here tell me this area is home to wild boars, but no one has ever sighted any trace of lions here or anywhere in Iran, unless in the very distant past. Perhaps what ancient Shir Gwaz inhabitants meant by the word lion was in fact the wolf or hyena. That's because those two species have lived in this region for hundreds of years. But what has brought me to this area of Baluchistan wasn't the lion or the boar. I've come here to see the Asian crocodile. Parlance, this rare species of crocodile is called the Gondo. They live somewhere between River Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gwaz. The river is the biggest natural stream of water in Baluchistan. It is known by different names by the locals living in villages located along its 300-kilometer course. Monikers such as Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gwaz. My team and I have to walk a long distance to see one of those short-nosed crocodiles. But these gorgeous, thick-skinned aquatic reptiles in Iran are said to be very shy animals, making it difficult for us to find one. What that means is you can't get too close to these amphibians and admire their beauty at close range. We have been going about gunning for a crocodile for a couple of hours now, but we haven't been able to see even one just yet. As I say, they are very shy animals. The locals tell me I'd be lucky to see one, though they also say if you wait long enough, you'll definitely be able to see at least one. Guide is around 3 meters long. The people in this area call them the Gondo. Who would have thought that you could see Gondos, the short-nosed Asian crocodiles, in a river in Iran's Sistan and Baluchistan province? At their biggest, these majestic reptiles are 3.5 meters long. The primary habitats of the short-nosed Asian crocodile are in Iran, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Myanmar. The people of Shir Gwaz tell me the best place to see the Gondos is the Shir Gwaz Dam, a barrier built across the Shir Gwaz River to impound its water. The number of crocodiles living in Iran has been estimated at between 300 and 400. The good news is the people of Sistan and Baluchistan do not do anything to endanger the survival of these adorable reptiles. The bond between them is unshakable. In general, the Baluch are kind, nature-loving human beings, traits that are rooted in these noble people's culture and creed. The love of nature and of animals is part of the life and culture of the Baluch people. Animals are part of the family, among them wild animals. Probably if this were another city or country, many people would try and, man, this guy is strong. I bet if I let him go, he's definitely gonna break my bones or break my camera into pieces. As I was saying, If this mountain goat were anywhere other than here, without a doubt some heartless poacher would have gunned it down by now. But the people here love animals dearly. The gondos that we saw earlier, they're conserving them so well. Also this wild goat, that's very close to the hearts of the people here. You can see many peacocks, partridges and pheasants in the households here in Shir Gwaz, and also in other villages elsewhere in Balochistan. The Shir Gwaz River flows past Bahu Kalad village, providing the hardworking community here with water for their farms, fruit groves, and animals. Perhaps there are many people in Iran who are unaware that the fruits grown in Balochistan can only be farmed in tropical climates. But that's exactly what's happening in this province. All of the Iranian banana produce comes from this region. Bahu Kalad is also among the important producers of watermelons in Iran. The cold season is when the watermelons grown here are harvested and distributed across the country. I've just stepped into a fruit grove in Bahu Kalad. In my opinion, this is a veritable piece of heaven. Here, you can see several different species of fruits right next to each other. Something you may not be able to see anywhere else in Iran. Fruits such as bananas, dates, mangoes, papaya, all kinds of citrus fruits. I've also been told that even coffee is farmed in some of the gardens here. It's just wonderful. I mean, you could go so far as calling this place Little India, located in southwestern Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles.
Stories,
stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Lantern, only here on IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for joining us again on this episode and sharing with us your precious time, lending us a listening ear. Life is a mess, without doubt. Especially now that we've been through 2020, which really was a madhouse on steroids. 2020 was on crack in the sense of how many ups and downs it had, how many people we lost. The pandemic came out of nowhere. The world hadn't seen a pandemic to itself since World War. I mean, it's been almost 100 years. I don't know what it is, but I personally feel that life has always been, this world at least, has always been a mess. Always. When was the last time you got a haircut, though? It must have been a long time ago, I think, because of the lockdown. Speaking of haircuts, let's listen to a short story about a blind barber. I'll be right back.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. This is Lantern. And as usual, we have an interesting story entitled The Blind Barber. Benjamin was a popular barber. He was skilled and had many regular customers. During his work, he used to talk eloquently to entertain and enlighten his customers. One day, a godly man visited his saloon. While cutting the hair, the barber declared that he did not believe that God existed. The barber described the pain, poverty, and suffering that people had to endure everywhere. He argued that if there was a God who was loving and mighty, he should have removed such misery from society. After his hair was cut, the godly man came out of the barber shop. In the street, he saw a madman with long and dirty hair and ugly beard. He returned to the saloon and told the barber, "Now I am sure that there are no barbers in the street." Why do you say that?" he inquired emphatically. Pointed to the madman, the godly man explained, "If there was a barber here, how could that man have such long and dirty hair and untrimmed ugly beard?" The barber defended his position. "I am the best barber in this city. There are several barbers in the other streets. That man is mad and does not come to any one of us to have a haircut. It's not our fault." The godly man replied, "That is quite true. Just like the barbers, God also exists. The problem is that people like you never search for him and refuse to meet him and seek his blessings. That is why you find so many in sorrow and suffering." The atheist could not argue further.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
So, as we were saying, the world's been on fire for quite some while. As a matter of fact, perhaps since forever. As a matter of fact, since before it was even created. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created Nabi Adam and said that said to his angels that I'm going to place him as my vicegerent on the earth, everyone was like, gasp. أَتَجْعَلُ فِيهَا مَا يُفْسِدُ فِيهَا وَيَسْفِكُ الدِّمَاءِ Are you going to place someone upon the earth who's going to bring about corruption and bloodshed? Not that Nabi Adam would do that, he was an infallible prophet, but by saying so, the dhamir, the noun of ha, ataj'alu fi ha, are you going to place within it, that it refers to earth, it indicates that it is the quality of this world. Hardships, calamities, difficulties, troubles, bloodshed, loss, anguish, pain, hurt, betrayal, massacres, genocides, wars, pandemics, the list goes on. All of this and so much more is the quality of this material world. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدْ. Verily, we have created mankind in hardship. From the moment that we are born, we step into this world kicking and screaming and crying. No infant is born from its mother's womb with a huge smile on its face. None whatsoever. All infants come to this world screaming their lungs out as if, where did you bring me? Why am I even here? I was comfortable in my mama's belly where it was warm and there was a layer of liquid and protection embracing me, no lights, no chaos, none of that. But it is what it is. And I'm not saying that, oh, this is just the state of the world and we're going to have to make do and we're going to have to settle with all the oppression and all the hardships that everyone's experiencing on the daily basis. Well, people get bombed, well, people die, well, people get hospitalized. It's just the way it is. I'm not saying that at all. That is in no way a reason for us to sit on our hands and be indifferent and nonchalant toward the hardships that people are going through. The same Quran that tells us we are born into difficulty tells us that we should fight and stand against oppression. We should defend ourselves when we are being driven out of our own homeland and our homes and our soil is being annexed by oppressive, colonizing tyrants. And the same religion that tells us to be patient in the face of calamities also tells us to do everything we can to make the situation better, and that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to change a people, the condition and the state of a people, unless they change what is within themselves. That's a verse from the Quran, by the way. What's my point? My point is that this world is so messed up, it is so easy that we can easily say that, well, because of this state of struggle, because of the injustice that is so prevalent on this planet, believing in an all-wise, all-kind, almighty, merciful Lord just doesn't make sense. If he is so kind, if he is so almighty, if he is so just and fair, how can he allow such calamities and tragedies to take place for people, for creations that he claims to love? Tell me, when was the last time a God-wary person consciously oppressed another human being, another creature? I mean, people make mistakes all the time, but if we think of those who are really God-wary, who really seen Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with their hearts, as Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam says. Because His Eminence has said that I do not worship a God I cannot see. And He also says that the eyes cannot see Him, rather He is seen by the true faith in the hearts of the believers. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.